such a distinction, on par with that proper to faith and to love on theistic basis, presents, to be sure, an advantage. It preserves the sense of the personality, which in these operative ceremonial forms continues to be supported by the body, but it has the disadvantage of limiting that personality. We have already had occasion to mention a series of experiences and trials that, in certain cases, are presented post-mortem. And according to the Tibetan teaching, consciousness would experience nothing but itself in these trials, its entire real content, and it alone would be called to recognize itself in the various apparitions that, so to speak, present it with as many myths of its transcendental nature. Here, that which it believes itself to be, the various relations of distance which it has established with the objects of its cult, plays a fundamental role, acts as an active force which confirms or destroys. The separation, it brings total integration, the great liberation. Closer, or it distances it. For whomever puts himself on such a path of magic moved by a spiritual aspiration and not by material ends, the 148. Same thing must be said, because the path of awakening is the same for the living and for the dead. Post-mortem experiences are equivalent with those that the initiate encounters in the course of his trials. But the habit incurred through ritual evocatory actions creates a spiritual barrier. The integration of all powers in a single center is undermined by it, and one proceeds along the frontiers of regions, which do not exclude illusion and possession. Having indicted this danger, we may mention another, of an opposite nature, presented by identifications. Having abolished that illusion of appearance as real individualities which deep forces might assume, and having assumed these forces directly in their formless aspect, it is necessary to bear in mind their possible nature. In ceremonial magic, and markedly in the magic of past times, there is often talk of elementals, and of other entities or forces which, while not presenting necessary a demonic character, also do not have a transcendent character, but belong to a world inferior to the one which, in principle, ought to characterize the level of the true man. One speaks moreover also of their urgent yearning to incarnate. This is moreover the Buddhistic teaching regarding the gods, conceived, in this doctrine, likewise without a supernatural character. But Eliphas Levi goes so far as to say that the angels aspire to make themselves men, and a perfect man, a man-god, stands over all the angels. And Kremers, there is a mighty flock of spirits desirous of immortality, and you are, by a fatal condition of the path, more greatly in contact with them, because they are all elementals of fire, they are thirsty, and you have the water to slake their thirst. Thus the quality of a being reintegrated in the invisible would act as a magnet and a condenser. Eliphas Levi speaks precisely a psychic vertex which, analogous to that which the waters form by whirling around an immobile and indestructible pillar, is constituted around the mage point 165, and it is a question of having strength enough to not be carried away, to not become the instrument for the desired incarnation of these energies which surround the adept and which issue from his now superconscious body. It is a question of reaching a point of conquering and radically transmuting their mode of being. It is then that these forces might compose, so to speak, organs and members of the incorruptible man. They unite intimately with the nucleus of the renewed soul, which, when necessary, might dispose of them even as it used, and still uses, its organs and physical. 149. Members, to act directly, or under the guise of apparently normal phenomena, which is to say, to create those signs, saturated with an illuminating power, of which we have already made mention when speaking of noble miracles. Moreover, in all this we are speaking of nothing but practical applications, and whoever thinks of these alone is destined to let the essential thing get away, as well as the right way which might conduct him to their realization. In the traditional teaching, as in the schools in question, which have taken that teaching up, the search for powers of in itself was considered as a deviation and a great danger. We have said at the beginning that magic as spiritual attitude, high magic or theurgy, is to be distinguished from magic as art of powers and of phenomena. In the mage, in the highest type of the mage, one should essentially see a being that has been released from the two bonds, from the human bond and from the divine bond, and who, whatever be the aspect that he assumes externally, resides with his forces and his formed effectively and stably in a region which lies beyond both this and any other world. By definition 166, the profane cannot penetrate the ways, the ends, and the path of such a being. Asterisk, asterisk, asterisk. Those who put forth doctrines of the kind do not put forth anything other than the teachings of a wisdom which, as a secret vein, the chain of awakening, as Meyrink calls it, runs through the weft of history, carrying one back ever to primordial times. And connected to this at bottom is the supreme interpretation of the various interpretations, not excluding one another or contradicting one another, but hierarchized, of which every material of true traditional spirituality, without regard to time and place, is susceptible. It is the virile aspect of that primordial tradition of which we have already spoken. Today, when there is almost not a single form of evocation and evasion which has not found place in the chaos of the unleashed Western spirituality, it has been perhaps necessary to cast light on some parts of this teaching, almost unveiled, in their integrity. We say almost, because is their appearance side by side with so many. Extravagance is not perhaps the best way of confounding him who does not have a right view. In this connection, and in place of a 150. Conclusion of these critical considerations, a few clear words are wanted. That which was the soul and axis of every great past civilization cannot be destroyed by a few centuries of modern superstition. Quite otherwise than as a datum of faith or as a mere dogma, there exists a supernatural reality, there exists a kingdom of the heavens, and also the liminal possibility of transmuting in it the fallen human personality into that of a semigod, participant in Olympic immortality. But, to express ourselves with traditional symbols, whose sense we hope will be by now clear to the reader, after the fall the way to such a region is barred by an angel with a flaming sword, and it is not for everyone, nor however for no one, to make oneself a vanquisher of angels and to use with impunity that violence which, according to the evangelical word, the kingdom of heaven may incur. The path of high magic has always been the path of the exceedingly few. But nowadays the mentality, the education, the heredity, the external circumstances, and the internal preoccupations, the entire way of feeling, of acting, of seeing and of desiring, constitute as in no other epoch an adverse condition with respect to that which, already in favorable times, constituted an exceptional realization. One should not delude oneself. Power, with which it is easy to confound the theurgic ideal, seems the watchword of the day, the myth proper to this age. In reality, things stand otherwise. There is an irreducible difference of plane. True magic, in the sense of high magic or theurgy, is a supernatural value. The modern aspiration to power is rather in everything and for everything naturalistic and profane. It is a Luciferian phenomenon, it manifests the hubris of the overbearing man who, without ceasing to be man, which is to say a terrene and animal creature, attempts to enslave those forces of the world by which he himself does not cease to be constituted and conditioned. Thus it is that the characteristics for which the magical ideal would seem almost to reflect itself and anticipate itself in modern man, so much so that there has even been a book recently on the Matindes magicians, 167 in reality constitute the most rigid barrier to every one of its realizations. In North America, the origin of a new world, as the salon philosopher Kieseling has called it, yoga and analogous disciplines have already regally culminated in the art. 151. Of healing through psychic means, in the petty method of becoming magnetizers and dominating characters so as to prepare for oneself the surest road to success in matrimony, in business, in politics, and so forth. Given these developments, it might tomorrow come to pass that certain subtle extranormal forces might even be able to enter into currency as the others have done, enrolled in the social service, or else enslaved to the hatreds and the profane ends of individuals and the masses. And thus we will have a condign masculine consort for mystical, humanitarian, vegetarian, democratic and feminist spiritualism overseas. Man is something that must be overcome. The principle remains true, but its sense is enclosed in the deeps, and, as we have seen, the tragic destiny of the solitary of Sils Maria seals it with a silent admonition for the few who can yet understand. As for the others, to read spiritualist works, to attend circles of theosophy, to meditate on the Mitalinkian unconscious guest, to perform. One's 20 minutes of daily concentration like a good child, full of moving faith in the reincarnation which will permit every soul to continue its evolution in a new existence, wherein it will harvest the fruits of the good humanitarian karma it has accumulated, this is truly a fine comfortable regime of overcoming. The original Christian doctrine, according to which one lives a single time and in this single life every fate is decided, including that of an eternal salvation and an eternal damnation, and which does not justify present life without a constant reference to God, sounds already as a salutary reveille against such slumbering mediocrity, such spiritualistic illusion and languor. And yet here we are still not dealing with anything but religion, and for that matter, remaining in the religious domain, as but a simple term of comparison, how many spiritualists of today would be disposed to leave the secular? Life for the cloister and monastic oath? Thus, we must not delude ourselves before displays of imitation and magic. Let them serve as the lines of the mountain range, as liminal points of reference, to clearly establish the distances, and not as the instruments of flattery and vanity. Let there be, together with these teachings, other teachings still borne ever in mind, whence holds the prohibition of the occult, the saying that one cannot see God without dying of the sight, and that he who has been bitten by the serpent of the spiritual world was thereafter. 152. Painted as a damned man. If there exists a right to ask any higher truth beyond this, such a right is measured inexorably by the capacity for a transfiguring conversion, for detachment and an absolute overcoming. It is an aristocratic right. The only right that the mob cannot ever usurp, not today, nor in any other epoch of the world. 153. H. Conclusion. Of these critical notes, many will feel perhaps disoriented, disappointed in their desire for a comforting truth and an easy path, after the suggestions offered by so many sects and movements. It is possible that these will feel even disturbed on account of the doctrines that here or there we have been constrained to take up and to make known, so as to put various things in their right place. These doctrines, indeed, often can play the killjoy with respect both to the sectarian spiritualist and his critic. For this reason, we do not hope to have attracted the sympathies of the one or the other. Such is the notorious way of things when one follows only the point of view of the truth, without any regard for sentimental and irrational factors, in questions to which strong internal tensions are connected. Whoever complains of not having had sufficient positive points of reference should keep in mind the nature of the regions in which we have had to move. To say something that appears positive to the many, we would have had to consider only the values that are applicable to the domain of the visible and the normal, in the conventional sense of these terms, to the zone closed both to nether influences which might arise in the spiritualistic evocations, and also to that other sphere, to the sphere of those initiatic possibilities and the disciplines of a high contemplative ascesis, reserved only to the few. We would have had to speak of the simple personality in its human form, and to say of this whatever might fortify it in relation to the present state of civilization. It would have been necessary to confront, then, essentially, the problem of the vision of the world, because this is the principle of everything. Even in the order of a spiritualism, in itself well-oriented, it is a grave error to believe that one might reach something serious through isolated practices, without having beforehand radically changed the way of feeling. Oneself, the others, the world, and without having also changed, in consequence, the manner of each one of our reactions. Much has 154 been written in this field from the time that one first began to speak of the crisis of modern civilization, but almost always without any solid principle. In truth, there exists but a single way for the defense of the personality, and this is the reclamation of the traditional vision of the world and of life, united to an internal revolt against the modern world. Now, in that work of ours which bears precisely this title, we have already given everything which was in our power to give in that direction, without entering into special domains. But in the present book our task was another. Here the question was essentially to furnish the precise sense of the two directions, the one toward the subpersonal, the other toward the superpersonal. This is indeed the indispensable condition to be able to orient oneself before contemporary spiritualism, to be able to verify that which is mask in it, and that which is face, to be able to overcome both. Philistine prejudices, as well as the flatteries of so many presumed. Revelations. From the start, we have recognized that a certain widening of horizons is now needed. To insist on prejudices and on limitations that even yesterday might have had their pragmatic raison d'etre is not prudent today, and is perhaps even dangerous. They might produce, on the contrary, the opposite effect, as experience itself has demonstrated. Let this be said above all to those who defend a religious tradition in the restricted, Routinarian 168 devotional and conformist sense. They, let us repeat it, ought to understand that the moment has come to awaken, if they wish to prove worthy of the task which in principle is incumbent on them. Once more, something vaster and more universal must be considered as tradition, something considerably less human than all that which they know and affirm. And this is possible without producing confusion, without weakening their positions, indeed, by reinforcing them. Ganon, with respect to Catholicism, has made this point clear. The horizon should be widened, not only in this field, but also in all the others we have touched upon in the preceding critical considerations. It is indeed a precise task for whomever has his eyes open to prevent, actively and expeditiously, all that which might occur in this sense through the work of uncontrollable influences. But then a test is imposed on modern man, that of knowing the limit which defines and sustains the sense of self before these widened horizons, that of knowing how to calmly close the great many doors. 155. Which luciferically 169 stand ajar, or which might open above or below him? Let us say it yet another time, in the greater part of these cases, the personality is not a datum, but a task. Today, in this epoch of the irrational and of the demonry of the collective, there are already all too many forces which one must resist and combat so as to approach such a task and to demonstrate a character and a line, without adding to them as well the hazards of spirituality. The spiritual has worth today as an awareness 170, not as a temptation. It must serve put the claims of the entirety of science and scientism to their place, to relativize the scope of not a few values of humanistic civilization, to remove ides fixes and mental deformations which have established themselves within many disciplines, and thus to enrich their possibility of development. The spiritual must also give us a way of repossessing precious parts of a forgotten and unknown heritage. It must, that is, give us the possibility of reading through the symbols and the myths of the great traditions of the past, something equivalent to reawakening new spiritual senses. The true spiritual man ought to arrive at feeling spirituality as a present reality, not exceptional but natural, not miraculous or sensational but evident in the framework of a sensation of the vaster, freer, more complete world. How far this spirituality then stands away from man, as something properly supernatural, is of no importance. What is important is the clarity and the naturalness of the awareness. To arrive so far as this would already be much. And yet it would be nothing more than a return to normalcy. To the degree to which the new spiritualism truly accommodates a revolution of the kind, precisely on account of that deviousness which is betrayed behind various of its forms, the Goethean saying holds good for it: it does good despite willing evil. The only means for favoring this revolution is to keep the traditional teachings clearly in sight, as teachings that act as rectifying or integrating counterpart to the ideas which today are widespread of spiritualism, including those of the pseudoscience of the one conscious. We have spoken not long ago of the protective function of the traditional conception of the world. Single in its essence, that is, in its values and in its fundamental categories, this vision admits, however, of various formulations and expressions. One can therefore inquire which of these formulations might be of most aid to the man of today. 156. When, with wider horizons, he comes to consider the supreme things, the many will think perhaps that it is the Christian formulation. We are not of this opinion. A formulation of the kind for the average man of today is either too much or too little. It is too little if one takes up a watered-down Christianity of the confessional and socializing sort, which we have discussed already. It is too much if one takes it in the tragic, desperate direction of the spirit, which we have also discussed, a direction which today either would not be felt or would lead one to dangerous imbalances. It should be underlined that here we are speaking expressly not of doctrinal elements or of theology, but precisely of that which a given formulation might give for an adequate, comprehensive vision of life. it is habitual to emphasize what Catholicism presents as a defense of the person. And in the preceding chapters, we ourselves have had occasion to make, here and there, certain recognitions in this connection. We are dealing, moreover, with values that Catholicism did not take from pure original Christianity, which was characterized by a desperate pathos for redemption and salvation united to every kind of suggestion and emotional complex. The values in question are rather better attested by the best vein of the classical tradition. And the problem presents itself as to whether those values, those elements of a vision of life, are not more fit and effective for the task indicated above, wherever they are liberated from a superstructure of faith and of dogma and reformulated with a greater adherence to their original root. We hold that precisely this is the case. We think, in other words, that it is from the classical conception of life that one might draw elements which are simpler, clearer, more neutral and deprived of tendencies, which the man of today might make his own toward renovating and broadening his mentality. This might occur in an autonomous way, without reference to a specific religious confession, to theories and philosophies. In the classical vision of life, diamonds and gods had their place. The world was considered, that is, in its totality, comprehending both the subnatural and the supernatural in the sense indicated at the beginning of the present book. At the same time, as perhaps in no other civilization, there was a living sense of the personality as a force, form, principle, value, task. It knew the invisible, but at its center it celebrated the ideal of culture, that is of spiritual formation, of the centralization almost of living and 157. Achieved works of art. As is known, one concept in particular had a primary role in the classical ethics, that of the limit, which brings us back precisely to what we recently stated, namely, our fundamental need to actively and consciously circumscribe the sphere in which one might truly be oneself, and to realize an equilibrium and a partial perfection, distancing oneself from the flatteries of the romantic and mystico-ecstatic paths toward the formless and limitless. It is thus that even with regard to the supreme things one might maintain an Apollonian tranquility of gaze. If classical man did not delude himself spiritualistically, if he therefore knew the double destiny, the road to Hades and the road toward the Isles of Blessed, even as he knew the law of the inferior world, the eternal cycle of generation, he knew at the same time that serenity, for which the hereafter created no vertigo, nor fate the least anguish, he knew that intimate bearing of soul that soothes the insatiable thirst of the things that flee, and by virtue of which he too, as Epicurus, could affirm, one time alone is one born, and one does not return to exist ever again, rejecting the idea of the gods as caretakers of men. And departing, he could say that he'd regretted not in the least that he should be departing a perfect life. In the essence, it precisely this kind of clear and calm heroism, united with dominion of oneself, with that equilibrium and neutrality in the sense indicated when speaking of Kremers, and made into a need in the life of the many, it is precisely this dominion which prevents new awarenesses from acting in a negative way. It is similar to knowing how to sustain oneself without supports, but with one's gaze open and one's soul free of the bond of overmanlike haughtiness. It is knowing how to look into the distances, but without vertigo. It is knowing how to form oneself intimately with a free activity, without the agitations of hope or fear, or the anguish which is betrayed in the various existential crisis philosophies which have become fashionable today. It is knowing how to love discipline and limit in themselves, never forgetting the dignity for which we are responsible and without excuses, up until that point at which a superior, austere vocation in someone might succeed in gathering all its strength, even to the most intimate, most abyssal roots of life, for the leap which might carry one beyond the human condition. 158. Notes. 1. The Italian for this Freudian concept is the capitalized version of its first-person subject pronoun, io. Evola uses this same word in many contexts, however, in which the use of the Freudian ego would be frankly inappropriate. I have therefore translated this word as egon whenever Evola is speaking explicitly of Freud or psychoanalysis, while in all other cases I have rendered it sometimes with ego, sometimes